It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk about art funding in Wisconsin. A national report ranks us very low, especially in contrast with states like Minnesota.
First, it's our regular Geek Out segment, where we explore people's passions for books, comics, games, and more.
Stevens Point author Patrick Rothfuss is with us now. He's the best-selling author of The King Killer Chronicle. That's a trilogy. The first book is The Name of the Wind. He's a regular guest on this segment. This week, we're talking about boys and girls, men and women in the geek world, and some controversy there. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of the things that get the geekiness label that we might talk about, the comics, the science fiction movies, video games, there's a stereotype that they're male, they're boy things. How accurate is that stereotype?
Well, as a stereotype, you're spot on. You know, if you say to somebody, if you say, think of a comic book geek, people will probably picture like an older, socially disadvantaged male of some sort, you know? They'll probably default to that Simpsons character or something like that. But the reality of the situation really is far gone from that. But the perception is there. That's causing some problems these days.
And there's been some back and forth lately about geek girls, and that's kind of our big topic today. What's going on there?
Well, it started, it's been kind of a slow fire. It started about a year ago at one of the big geek conventions at Comic-Con, and somebody posted up a blog pretty much complaining about the prevalence of, and I quote, fake geek girls. Because, and the person pretty much said, I actually pulled up the blog here so I can quote him accurately. And he says, this is hardly the only convention populated with hot chicks wearing skimpy outfits simply to get a bunch of geeks' heads to turn just to satisfy their hollow egos. And he goes on for hundreds of words talking about how a real geek girl is different from a fake geek girl, effectively saying that these people are okay and they can come to the con and they can dress up, but these other people, well, no, they're just trying to get attention and they're fake geek girls and they don't belong at this con. And, you know, if this were a solo thing, it would kind of be like one sad, lonely, angry person crying in the wilderness. But it actually reveals like a big creepy thing that happens in geek fandom, where a lot of people treat women really, really, really badly, as if they don't belong in our clubhouse.
And what's up with that? I mean, you'd think after years of being stereotyped as the awkward males, no girls to be seen, kind of a He-Man club of weird individuals, you'd think they'd welcome the contradiction of that stereotype.
When I was out at Comic-Con this year, I heard he go on a rant that was exactly that, where he was this older gentleman, maybe about 5-10 years older than me, you know, pretty much swore a blue streak. He's like, I can't believe guys are upset that girls are getting into comics and they're getting into video games. He goes, do you know that we would have killed to have some of those girls back then? But you know what it comes down to? It's the fact that some of these people do feel like, effectively, these first off, that women, what I hear repeated on some of these blogs is that they haven't really paid their dues, where if you're a geek, that means you're obsessive about something and you're socially ostracized because you love something that nobody else does. And, you know, that effectively being socially ostracized is your ticket into being a geek. But pretty women apparently can't be socially ostracized, and therefore they can't be geeks, and so they have no business doing this. You know, and honestly, it's really bizarre, because you would think that somebody who had kind of been picked on would avoid picking on other people or avoid that exclusionary behavior that they'd then suffered from. But it's really the exact opposite is true. And ultimately, what it's really doing is revealing some of the really creepy and icky sexism that exists in comics and in sci-fi and fantasy and in some of these games. There's just some weird stuff in that community right now.
Is it that community, or is this something that would happen in any traditionally male domain, whether it's sports fans or an old golf course, a country club that was traditionally all male? Is there going to be that any reaction when you first get a new group joining in with the old group?
Well, and that actually I think is a really good point. I don't think it's exclusively. It's exclusively a male characteristic where I know, I've dealt with it a little bit because, as a feminist, sometimes I show up to a meeting and because I'm a big beardy guy, occasionally I get a raised eyebrow, or somebody saying, boy, you don't look like a feminist, but those people usually aren't feminists. Real feminists get why I'm there and that we're all in this together. I think that in some ways, because our culture is a little male, well, not a little male dominated, we're painfully male dominated, in this particular subculture, people are very resistant to admitting that we have these sexist things going on in sci-fi and fantasy, in the gaming world, in the comic world. There's actually something blowing up even as we speak. A bunch of comic book authors were kind of brought to task about the fact that all of these comics feature, terrible brutalization of women and sexualization of women and contributing to rape culture. And these panel of authors all pretty much said, oh, we just reflect the culture. We don't participate in it. they just washed their hands of responsibility for their own, what they put into their art. And all of these things happening at the same time, it's just a little creepy.
And there's also a chicken or the egg question in the content. Genres, they say, whether we're talking comics or a lot of the other things we've touched on, are they aimed at men because women aren't interested in the first place? Or are women maybe going to be less interested because these are genres that target men?
I think you're absolutely right. And it is absolutely chicken and egg. And a lot of times it's self-perpetuating, where you see that with a lot of commercial art, where people say, well, you don't want to try to write, and that's actually what a lot of these guys on this comics panel said. They said, well, you don't want to write, a comic with a lot of minorities in it because those comics won't sell. And they're like, well, women aren't really minorities in the first part. But since that's what the writers believe and that's what the editors believe, then that's what is actually produced, and so that's the only thing that can sell. So it kind of, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy right there. But you're right; it's a culture that has gotten big enough that it can kind of sustain its own self-deception there.
Something that's weird is, circling back to the debate over who really belongs in geek culture. The fact that it is viewed as a positive that you would want membership in it. Isn't that a huge change from not too terribly long ago?
It is. Well, I think, when I was going to grad school, somebody said, there was a joke that we all would tell each other when I was getting my English Lit degree. And they said, well, why the competition is so fierce to get your English master's degree? It's because the stakes are so incredibly small. And, it's one of those jokes you tell when your life is really awful and you really kind of hate everything about your existence. And I think that's really what's going on here is, people who kind of grew up socially ostracized and they got picked on because they played D&D and they, weren't, on the football team or whatever else. Now they feel like everybody has it so easy. Now you get to be a geek and be popular. You get to play football and play Xbox. And, you know, and they feel a little bitter about that. But there's no controversy about fake geek boys out there. You know, like if a guy comes in wearing a football jersey into a comic shop, nobody, you know, gives him a weird look. Nobody makes fun of him. But women are. There's this a great video that I highly recommend everyone check out. It's called Nothing to Prove by a pair of great geek musicians. They're a group called the Double Clicks. And they talk about this problem, about the fact that, you know, women go into comic book stores and they get harassed. Women own comic book stores and they get harassed, you know? And I've never seen it illustrated as well as in this video. You know, it's 4 minutes of your time. It's absolutely worth the price of admission. It really illustrates this point very well.
Nothing to Prove by the Double Clicks. We'll put a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today, and look forward to the next installment of Geek Out.
Thank you.
That's Patrick Rothfuss, author of The Name of the Wind and the trilogy that follows it. He's a regular guest on our Geek Out segment.
Coming up next, a look at arts funding in Wisconsin. New research shows we're near the bottom of the pack when it comes to spending money on the arts. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. Rob Verrett here with Cynthia Schuster.
You ain't nothing but a hound been snooping around the door.
You may recognize that. It's one of Elvis Presley's biggest hits, but it's not actually the King's original.
That's right. Hound Dog was recorded for the first time on this day in 1952 by Big Mama Thornton, 4 years before it became Elvis's longest-running number one hit on the charts.
Speaking of the King, though, this is Elvis Week, and WPR producer Robin Cherry is heading to Graceland today to cover the event.
She'll be joining us at this time on Friday from Graceland to give us the lowdown.
Now, when we see a story that compares Wisconsin to our neighbor to the west, Minnesota, it catches our attention. When we see that they're number one and we're number 47, we definitely take notice.
Those rankings come from the National Assembly of State Arts Agencies, which just released new figures measuring the amount state governments spend on the arts. Minnesota spends $6.36 per capita on its state art agencies, and Wisconsin spends just 13 cents per capita.
Our next guest is worried about that. He says it's time to get creative in calling for more arts funding, or get used to Minnesota's art scene yanking creative talent and dollars over the state line.
We want to know what you think. Would you like to see Wisconsin spend more in the arts? Or do you think it's the private sector's responsibility to take care of that? Maybe you're someone who has left Wisconsin for an area with a more vibrant art scene. You can tell us about it at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org.
Tom Giffey is managing editor of Volume 1, a news, arts, and culture publication based in Eau Claire. He wrote a piece called Economic Envy for Minnesota Arts. Tom joins us from our studio in Eau Claire. Hello, Tom.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So you recently crossed the border to Minnesota to experience the art scene there. Tell us about it, and how did it get you thinking about this issue?
Well, it was sort of a coincidence that I spent two consecutive weekends back in June and July experiencing theater over in the Twin Cities. And, of course, that's something a lot of us in western Wisconsin do, go over there to enjoy the art scene, because in part it is such a huge metropolis that there are just, by virtue of that, more offerings. But that happened to occur at the same time that I saw this report, as you mentioned, that show we are so far behind the national average as well as our peer states, especially Minnesota, in that area. And it just so happens the two theater productions I attended were both in facilities that were at least partly publicly funded in one way or another. One is the Centennial Showboat, which is a program of the University of Minnesota where they do old vaudeville-style productions on a paddle wheel boat in the Mississippi River, which is a very, I can say, certainly a unique experience. for the theater goer. And the other was a show at the Guthrie Theater, which was built, the new Guthrie Theater, I should say, which was built in the past 10 years with the help of some state bonding over there. And that got me thinking about why there is such a gulf and what that means to the arts economy and the overall economy in Wisconsin, and in particular, our part of the state.
Well, why do you reckon there is this big gulf? Minnesota 21, us number one, us number 47 in this ranking.
It's a good question. I mean, part of our low ranking is certainly the budgetary constrictions the state has had in the past few years as a result of the recession. And the national report you mentioned certainly does indicate that. If you look over time, all states have seen a decline and maybe are seeing a slight rise now that the nation has pulled itself out of recession. But Minnesota has always seemed to have stronger support for the arts. The $6.36 per capita that you refer to, that is at least partly due to a constitutional amendment that they passed a few years ago, which mandates that a certain part of the sales tax receipts of the state will be set aside for natural resources preservation as well as the arts. As I refer to in the column, they love arts funding so much they actually wrote it into the Constitution. I think that expires after 25 years, so we'll see what happens after that. But it's hard to explain. There just seems to be a better value and a better emphasis placed on the arts, at least publicly funding the arts in that state, than in this state. And that's not to detract from any of the great creative people we have in this state. The point I kind of wanted to make with this article is to say, hey, we do great considering the resources we invested. If we just did a little bit more, how much better could we be?
Well, there's kind of a philosophical issue here, too, about the role of government. Arts, great, love them, someone could say, but why should the government be spending tax money on it and picking the art? We see, you know, the art market, in effect, will give us the art we need.
That's an excellent question and a big philosophical debate here. When I was researching the column, as I referred to, the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis got some state funding. That was vetoed several times by Jesse Ventura when he was governor. And he said, quote, if I give money to a theater, why not support stock car racing? Maybe that's a good point. Maybe we need public funding for stock car racing. But the underlying thing here is that this is a form of economic development. The small amounts of money for example, the Wisconsin Arts Board can put toward an organization so it can bring art and culture groups into a community like the small town of Dodgeville that I grew up in, which the small cultural arts committee there got assistance from the Wisconsin Arts Board. It really adds value to our state, and not only from the experience of being able to see productions that you might or performers you might not have. It simply, it brings in economic vitality, not only because you are supporting artists, but other creative people want to be around artists. In our own community here of Eau Claire, there is a software company called Jamf, J-A-M-F, founded by a UW-Eau Claire graduate who also played music at the university. And he says that one of the reasons he is growing his company here, and it's an international firm, they've got offices around the world, but he's growing it here because of the creative vitality of Eau Claire in western Wisconsin. There's a possibility that we could have a great new art center in the downtown of our community that is going to be a combined university community project. And Jamf Software is building its a new office building downtown, in part because they want to be near that. The creative people who write computer code want to be around the creative people that make art and that perform on stage and that play music. There's a lot of synergy there. If I may belabor the point, this article's been on our website for a while, and we've gotten some interesting comments. One of them I saw today was from a graphic artist who lived for a number of years in Eau Claire and found that he recently had to move to Hudson, Wisconsin, which is right on the state line, because he would be closer to the kinds of companies in the Twin Cities that want to hire a graphic artist to do that creative work. He said, I love Eau Claire, I love what we have there, but I simply can't support myself in the way I need to by living in Eau Claire. I've got to be drawn closer to the border.
We're talking with Tom Giffey about the difference in art spending between Minnesota and Wisconsin. And we're going to start taking your calls after the break, including Elizabeth in Genoa City. Hang on there, and we'll get to you soon after the news. We want to know what you think. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see Wisconsin put more public money, tax money, into supporting the arts? Or not? Why or why not? The number again, 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And hey, we've got that Twitter thing too, Central Time WPR, with a little at symbol before it. Let us know what you think.
We'll take, as Rob said, we'll take your calls right after the news. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Tom Giffey from Volume 1 in Eau Claire about the difference in art spending between Minnesota, number one among states in a recent study, and Wisconsin, number 47 in per-person art spending. We want to know what you think. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tom, we'll go right to the phones now. We have Elizabeth with us in Genoa City. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello.
What do you think about this?
Well, I just did a straight shot from Colorado back to my house in Wisconsin on the state line. I was appalled, you know, at these wonderful, I mean, I say not appalled, I was just really, really excited to see these gateway arches on 80 going across the country, two huge ones that were, one I believe was attributed to the fur trade route, and the other had these huge spikes that looked just great from far away, and then going under them, seeing them in different perspectives. And it really, if I had more time, would have loved to stop and see more about it. Then it actually spurred on great conversation with the children riding in my car that are both budding artists. And then I just want to mention I'm going to be at a Horse and Drum Show at St. Charles this weekend. So I really hope it's an equine horse show with the powwow and the Arcata Theater in St. Charles doing the first equine horse movie fest. And I would love to see more art spent in this state, as it occurs to me Minnesota has one location. I've really enjoyed Minneapolis, where my sister was going to college. But here there are so many great locations that it could, you know, our states, Lake Geneva, you know, our big cities, Milwaukee, Madison, up north, Green Bay, the, you know, just like the whole area has great locations, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan. So how would you, you know, how would you spread it out?
Gotcha.
That's a good question, too. Well,
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. And let's start with that question. How, you know, you mentioned, Tom, you've got this really concentrated, well-funded metro area up there in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Can we have a more dispersed statewide approach to getting art out there?
Right. That's an excellent question. I think that's where the Wisconsin Art Board has traditionally come in, by providing what I talked to George Sugros, the executive director of that agency, and he talked about it as sort of the good housekeeping seal of approval. They give a little bit of money to an arts organization here in Eau Claire, or say my hometown of Dodgeville, as I mentioned, or in a bigger city like Madison. And that can help draw other foundation funding and private funding to support an event, a series of events, an arts center, what have you, all the kinds of different things that can both have aesthetic value, like those monuments along the highway, or just, as we spoke earlier about, the economic value. And I think that's why we have a state art agency, to kind of spread that out so it isn't all concentrated in say, Madison and Milwaukee. But again, that spending for that agency has gone down precipitously. It was in the 2009 state budget, we ranked 40th among the states at 43 cents per capita, which seemed fairly low. And of course, now we are down to 13 cents per capita.
You know, mentioning those columns on the highway, and Gavin on Facebook writes, is there a way to get arts funding tied to transportation funds? It might not be much, but what if we had statuary or murals to go along with, you know, new overpasses and roundabouts constructed each year?
That's an interesting point. I mean, that there used to be what they call the percent for arts program in Wisconsin, where 0.2% of state building projects had to be spent on art, which, of course, made those projects more beautiful and helped some artists pay the bills. But ultimately, what this argument is about, that I was trying to at least push forward a little bit, is not so much about those artistic things that we can see, but things that we can do in our community and things that inspire creativity and inspire creative people who maybe are inventing something. A scientist who's working on a problem, as we heard in the news break, they're talking about National Institute of Health funding that has declined over the years. All those creative people are drawn to be in the same places. So when you plant some seeds for the arts, it will bring other people who can create economic growth that lifts all the boats. One of the common complaints you hear in this realm is, well, the free market will provide it, or I don't want to subsidize your night out at the theater. That was one of the comments I heard online from my column, and that's not it at all. We collectively pay for certain things via our tax dollars because we think they are good for all of us, even if we don't individually visit that park, drive on that highway, attend that school. We recognize as a society that it helps all of us and helps our economy by supporting these things, and I think the arts are no different.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have David with us in Hudson. David, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing real good. How about you?
I am doing great, and I'm so happy that we're talking about this right now because I think it's really important. I agree that we should be raising our spending on arts in Wisconsin, because I think when people see that we're 47th in funding for arts in Wisconsin, it sets the idea that it's not as important to us as, say, Minnesota, for example. And I feel like if we increase our spending, it shows that the government supports and wants to bring in more art. And if people see that we're increasing our spending and wanting to improve on the art scene in Wisconsin, then more people will come and we'll be diversified in our art. And I think that's really important.
Gotcha. David, thanks for the call. What do you think of that? It sends a message, our level of spending on art.
Well, it certainly does send a message. One of the great and most poignant comments I've heard in this whole discussion is from Max Garland, who is Wisconsin's poet laureate and a professor of English here at UW-Eau Claire, who said, "I need someone to tell me how I'm supposed to hide from my students the fact that they live in a state that supports the arts at 13 cents per capita, but that they can drive a little more than an hour and be in a state that supports the arts at $6.36 per capita." That's acute for us here in, especially in western Wisconsin, where we're on the border and we're competing with that state in so many different areas, that you creative minds are often almost inevitably drawn to Minnesota. And you're not, of course, going to stop that kind of thing. We talk in the academic world about brain drain. But if we can do just a little better, we can keep more of those people in our state, on our side of the border. And I think that sends a signal to all the people of the state that we value creativity and we value economic growth.
Thanks for the call, David. We've got Lynn in Eau Claire next. Hi there, Lynn.
Hi there. I think that an under-recognized and underutilized venue for arts here in western Wisconsin are our county fairs. 4-H is an amazing organization. Aside from animal husbandry, you have culinary arts, photography, textile arts, etc. And it's not only for children. They have what I like to call the old broad division, the open division, where I get to shine. And it's a wonderful, wonderful venue to start young artists.
great. Thank you so much, Lynn. And I know I've seen those textile displays at State Fair over the years. That speaks to the idea of kind of getting creative on how we reach out and support the arts, doesn't it?
Well, as she points out, it's important to recognize the arts are not just going to a great big theater or seeing the symphony orchestra. It's things we experience in our everyday life that add value to our lives, both sort of culturally and spiritually even, but also economically. And they are all around us, and we have to appreciate them. And by supporting public funding, even just a little more public funding for the arts, we can spur many more of those things in our communities.
Thanks a lot for the call, Lynn. We have John in McFarland with us now. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to make a comment that as an artist myself, I'd certainly love to see more funding available. As an individual artist, it doesn't represent an organization or something. I've received some grants from the county, but it's very difficult to, there's not even a grants program right now, I believe, for the Wisconsin Arts Board to be able to distribute to individual artists. And I want to make a comment that it's not really fair to compare Minnesota with Wisconsin, because Minneapolis and St. Paul is a town more on the size of Chicago.
Right.
Or a city more on the size of Chicago, and Rochester is near that as well. They have a much larger tax base, and the only way you're going to grow that and have more money available for the arts per capita is if you have a state that is more attractive to business and investment. And we constantly talk, especially on public radio, about how we only seem to talk about teachers and public servants and what they get paid and how that affects the state, but the state gets mostly affected by our economic vitality. And I think with stronger economics and an understanding or a humanitarian approach, we can make these things become a little bit more balanced.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, John. So if we build the economy, the arts will come.
Yeah, and that's one thing that these numbers don't reflect, of course, because this is only state funding. In Minnesota, you know, it is a state with sort of similar demographics, similar population to us, but they have a lot more. They have that big concentrated metropolis, and they also have lots of corporate headquarters, and many of those corporations are very generous donors to the arts, and that even makes the scene even more vibrant in Minnesota. So it is something of an apples to oranges comparison. To be sure.
Tom, we're getting a lot of interest in this, and I'm going to be honest with you, we're not reaching our next guest. I'm going to ask you on the fly, can you hang out with us for another 10 minutes or so?
I certainly can.
Okay, well, you're up there in our studio in Eau Claire. Thanks for sticking around there. We're talking to Tom Giffey, and we'll continue talking to him. He's managing editor at Volume 1 in Eau Claire. You can join in, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. Do you want to see more arts funding in Wisconsin? Why is art important in your community and to our economy? I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. We're talking to Tom Giffey, managing editor at Volume 1 in Eau Claire. Tom, you've like a successful show, a Broadway show. You were extending your run a little bit. And thanks for staying with us. We were talking about arts funding in Wisconsin, pegged to some new research saying Wisconsin's number 47th in the country among states for per-person art investment. Our neighbors in Minnesota, number one. He says that's drawing at least a lot of business and maybe some people across the border there. And we'll go back to your calls now. Sally is with us in De Pere. Sally, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm actually a teacher at a performing arts studio in Northeast Wisconsin. And one of the things we've had a lot of kids coming to us because programs are getting cut in schools and there aren't the arts programs there. And then we get companies who contact us and want to know about people who have experience with this, because companies are looking for people who have that experience in creativity, thinking outside of the box, teamwork, which is so important when you're doing the arts. You have to work with others, and I just don't understand why there's this disconnect between what the schools are getting funding for and then what companies are actually looking for.
Gotcha. Sally, thanks for the call. So that's another side of the art and economy question. She's saying the modern economy, high-tech economy, wants creative people, and we need the arts to train them in that.
Exactly. As I noted earlier in the hour, we have a large software firm that is growing exponentially here in Eau Claire. And part of the reason that they are adding jobs there, as the owner has stated, is that this is a place where there is some creativity because the performing arts are fairly strong in our community. And creative people simply like to be around other creative people.
Thanks a lot for the call, Sally. We'll go to Milwaukee next with Donald. Donald, hi.
Hi, I was calling. I was wondering if instead of supporting the arts second, as a previous caller had mentioned, and instead focusing on economy, if you focused on the arts and maybe creating a program for how you divvy up the spending so as to first maybe supporting a theater in a neighborhood that is more economically deprived, or maybe a school or a studio, and seeing how that might change the neighborhood and the community as an activity, and also to bring other businesses into that community. For instance, a theater might attract restaurants or trendier bars.
Gotcha, Donald. I think I take your point. So, Tom, targeting areas that need economic development with some of this public art spending to try to give a little jump start to the local economy.
Certainly, and I think it's a kind of a chicken and egg phenomenon. You can say, well, if we improve the overall economy, that will provide us more money, public and private, to support the arts. But I think also if you put investment at the front end, it's like any other economic development project. If it's done well, you invest some. Perhaps, you know, as we have, tax incremental financing districts or other programs in the state that target kind of perhaps blighted or undeveloped or underdeveloped areas, you could do the same with arts funding. That is a good idea.
Donald, thanks for the call. We have Susan next in Milwaukee. Hello, Susan.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question, and that is, how can we be sure that the amount of money they're saying is being allotted to the grants or the art funds is actually happening? Because as far as I'm seeing, there's huge amounts of money that are supposedly going to the arts but being reallocated to other needs. Let me give you an example. The Dennis Oppenheim blue shirt was petitioned against by Scott Walker, and then he kept the remaining funds that they were getting for that sculpture once he eliminated that sculpture. Then he, the other one is Hartung Park. There was a bronze casting given a grant for $20,000. And once they got the funds, they rewrote the grant from Greater Milwaukee Arts Foundation to pay for, quote, whatever they wanted. And they also had donation-level sculptures where they reallocated those funds towards whatever they wanted as well.
So gotcha. So Tom, money being maybe all the money that we think we're spending maybe isn't getting there to the arts anyway.
That's certainly a possibility. I don't know about either of those cases. I assume the agencies that give out the money are like any others, that they're doing their due diligence to make sure that the money is actually going where it's supposed to be going.
All right, Tom, we can wrap up now, but briefly, are you optimistic? Do you think Wisconsin will make more of a priority of arts funding?
It's really hard to say. I know that a few years ago, folks on the arts board were talking about, you know, if we could just get up to a dollar per capita, boy, that would be great. And obviously, we've moved in the opposite direction. I think it will require more political will, and it will require people from no matter what their political perspective of realizing that the arts is intrinsically tied not only to the quality of life of the state, which therefore helps develop the economy, but is literally a form of economic development itself. So I guess there is a little hope there, and obviously people of artistic bent are creative. So I would invite them to think of creative ways that they can encourage their leaders to make this a priority.
Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Tom Giffey, managing editor at Volume 1 in Eau Claire. We'll now go to our next guest. We have him with us now. John Rufford, based in Damascus, Syria, until 2 months ago.
And John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you left Damascus only 2 months ago. What was it like seeing that city through 2 years of civil war?
What was it like to? Well, it was certainly a learning process. It wasn't war every day. A lot of the time, it was relatively calm. But you lived with the sounds of war constantly, which at the very beginning was quite terrifying, and then you kind of adapt to it. And over time, you go through that peaks and troughs of dealing with the threat, really.
Mm-hmm. And I want to mention you're a photographer, and so you've recorded a lot of what's been going on around you. But how do you decide who or what to photograph and what your focus is going to be?
Well, in actual fact, over the last 2 years, I haven't been photographing anything in Damascus. I have residency there, but I was not allowed to work during the current situation. I needed permission, or I needed to go behind the government's back, the permission wasn't granted, and going behind their back was not really a sensible thing to do if I wanted to keep my residency. I worked as a photographer in the country before, but not during the current crisis.
Mm-hmm. You had once said you weren't about to leave Syria, but you ultimately did a couple of months ago. Why did you leave?
Well, I left partly because I'd had problems with security, who perhaps thought I was working as a journalist or a photographer. Which I hadn't been doing, but I had been giving one or two interviews, and I had been, the reason I stayed for 2 years not working was that I felt it was important that I was there to see what was happening, even if I wasn't able to photograph it, at least I was able to witness it. It's an important time. It's often misrepresented in the media. And for me, I felt it. I felt very strongly that I should be able to see what was happening. Eventually, a combination of things kind of prompted me to leave: an investigation by the security services, and financially, I needed to earn a living.
So, what are the media missing when it comes to covering the Syrian civil war?
Well, one of the first things that most of the politicians say is that it's a complicated situation, and it is a complicated situation. And the media either covers the revolutionary or the opposition side and follows around various brigades from the various armed groups fighting the government, or the media comes in with the permission of the government and is kind of controlled to a certain degree. A lot of the journalists that come in don't have any experience of the country and don't really know, don't have an understanding of the way things work and what have you. And it's very difficult to get an accurate perspective. Well, I spoke to a journalist.
John Rufford, I'm so sorry that we can't spend more time with you. We do have to get to a news break. That was John Rufford, based in Damascus up until 2 months ago. His work has appeared in the New York Times and The Guardian, and his website is johnrufford.com if you'd like to learn more.
Coming up, a new documentary has people talking about texting while driving. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.